we're changing tax slightly with the next agenda paper. So agenda paper 5 is a different paper to the ones we usually discuss. So this is talking about a topic actually that will be discussed by the board at the board meeting next week on whether or not we should consider making some changes to the requirements in IAS 8 to deal with what the effect is on transition if we issue agenda decisions. The purpose of this discussion is really to get your thoughts, responses, comments, feedback on this paper, and the intention will be that the staff will then give the board a verbal update of what you thought when we discuss the paper at the board meeting next week. And obviously, given it affects what the consequences of what you decide to do, your opinions are going to be very much of interest to the board. So with that, I'll hand over to Javid.
Yeah, thank you. So turning your attention to agenda paper 5. Who already mentioned that we're just seeking your feedback and input, which we will provide to the board next week at the board meeting. So just to set some background, applying IAS 8 and entity changes in accounting policy retrospectively, if the change is either required by IFRS standards or if the change results in the financial statements providing reliable but more relevant information, which I will refer to as voluntary change in accounting policy. So an entity applies a voluntary change in accounting policy retrospectively unless it's impracticable to do so. Impracticable is a very high threshold. Now, when the board or the committee develops new standards or amend existing requirements in IFRS standards, they consider transition and often provide entities with some relief from retrospective application, usually due to cost-benefit considerations. However, this same relief is not available to entities that wish to voluntarily change their accounting policies, and this can be seen as creating a barrier for entities that wish to adopt better accounting policies. We also understand that one of the more common reasons that entities voluntarily change their accounting policies is because of agenda decisions published by the committee. Now, because agenda decisions are non-authoritative, any change resulting from an agenda decision is not a change that's required by an IFRS standard. So unless the change is seen as a correction of an error, it's usually applied as a voluntary change in an accounting policy. Again, because it's non-authoritative, neither the committee nor the board can provide transition relief or can specify an effective date for these agenda decisions. And this can be problematic in some cases because the benefits of applying this change retrospectively may not always outweigh the cost. And this can be seen as a barrier. It can be seen as something that prevents entities from sending submissions to the committee. And it also prevents agenda decisions from being viewed as helpful, informative, and persuasive. In addition, in some situations, the committee may recommend standard setting solely for transition consideration. Now, the paper that we have for the board, which is in Appendix A to Paper 5, explores a possible solution to address these challenges. We are not aware of any concerns with respect to the requirements in IAS 8 for correction of errors, and therefore we did not pursue any alternative that would require a change to that aspect of the standard. Appendix A also outlines another alternative we considered but did not pursue. We think one possible solution could involve lowering the impracticability threshold to a cost-benefit threshold. The board could amend IAS 8 to require entities to apply this reduced cost-benefit threshold either to all voluntary changes in accounting policies or only to changes resulting from agenda decisions. The two alternatives are outlined in paragraph 28 and 29 of the board paper. And paragraph 30 to 44 provide a comparative analysis of these two alternatives. On balance, we are recommending that the board amend IAS 8 to apply this cost-benefit threshold to changes in accounting policies resulting from agenda decisions. I would now like to turn your attention to the first question on page 2 of paper 5 and ask if you think whether making the amendment to IAS 8 as we are recommending would help facilitate entities changing an accounting policy to reflect the explanatory material. It would be helpful if you could support your answer with explaining why or why not, and if you think the amendment would not help, if you could provide any alternative that you think could work as well. So with that, I'll open the discussion.
You know what? This is Sandy. I was curious, why is this topic coming up now? This issue has existed for a while. Why is this coming up as something to be addressed at this moment?
I think you're right. It's not a new issue. It's something that's been coming up for a while. But I think we're trying to think proactively about ways to improve the process and the ability our effectiveness in supporting those applying our standards. And it seems that one of the challenges we have with issuing agenda decisions is sometimes the decisions around what we end up doing can be, you know, quite driven by transition. And if there are ways to achieve the benefits of these agenda decisions, which are, you know, where we've decided that we don't need standard setting activity, if we can find a mechanism that makes it a more efficient and effective process, we think it's helpful to the system. So I don't think there's any particular reason that it's coming up now, other than that I think now that the committee's more active, perhaps it brings it more to front of mind. But also we're just looking at ways to improve the process, because we have had some criticisms in the past that the committee's not doing enough. And so this is a way of making us more effective.
Okay, thank you.
Bruce?
Thank you. To start off with, I think it's long overdue that we've had this discussion. And the reason I say that is, bear in mind, I come from a region where agenda decisions are not mandated by any of the regulators or any of the authorities. So as much as they're seen as guidance, they've kind of left us in this vacuum of never really understanding how we're meant to do anything about them. As far as the paper goes, I mean, I agree, there's no issue on the errors. I mean, that's not too much of a problem. But our experience has always been that the impracticability threshold is a very high hurdle. I think that it's been a bit of a challenge. So the question is, how do you address it? Where do you start on this? I do support that. I think we need to do something on ISA, because I do think that there are situations where companies want to change for better accounting, but the impracticability and having to do the full retrospective restatement, it's just got to a stage where they're not doing the better thing because it's just too onerous to do it. So I support the doing something to get to a situation where the voluntary changes can get us to that. Do I think we can distinguish an agenda decision restatement from something else? Absolutely not. And the reason I say that is because the moment we introduce a requirement separately for an agenda decision and you refer to them in IS8, they're part of GAP. They are in the standards, and I think that then we're going to have to relook at everything we do in terms of due process. We're now telling people how to do things in the standards that have not necessarily been through the board. I mean, yes, we've done a degree of due process, but we haven't done full standard setting due process as we're required to do. And as much as I like the answer of that, because I think it gets us to a practical answer in terms of agenda decisions, I think it's going to be a hard sell. Because I think it's going to be very difficult to justify, well, why is an agenda decision, which has really not gone through the board and through due process, now getting this wonderful ability to do something. I think we've already had the accusation of backdoor standard setting. My worry is I think that this would be backdoor standard setting, where we're using it as a mechanism to get something out very quickly. So if I had to look at what I propose, I do agree with to do something with it. I like the cost-benefit option. I think that providing we put in the guidance, as you said, we would need more guidance on that. Because I don't think it's something that's very prevalent in what we're doing here. I like the idea of doing it. I like the cost-benefit exemption. I don't think we could distinguish a normal voluntary change from an agenda decision.
So are you then saying that your preference would be that this proposal, and in particular the cost-benefit piece of it, would be applicable to all voluntary changes in the country?
As I said, I would love it to be just for agenda decisions. I don't think it's possible.
I likewise commend the staff for taking on this project because it does address a real practical issue that we face, particularly in light of the fact that we are more open to issuing educative agenda decisions. What I do, however, see as a distinction between agenda decisions and other voluntary changes in accounting policies that companies may make is the fact that agenda decisions, once they're finalized, And given that many regulators see them as in substance mandatory, a company has to implement them. So think of, for example, we come up with finalizing some agenda decisions at our meeting here today, June. Companies will have to implement that in their semi-annual financial statements or Q2 financial statements. And the impracticability threshold at that point in time may be higher than if they had more time. And what I'm saying in another way around is if you're making a voluntary change in accounting policy, other changes where you see them as being reliable but more relevant, companies typically have time on their side to do investigation, determine what all the impacts are, et cetera. So I do think it is different with respect to agenda decisions, and so I would be supportive of moving along these lines. The one hesitation that I have, though, is that to date the board seems to have viewed the benefit part of the cost-benefit equation to be something that the board takes into account, because benefits from a user's from an entity's perspective are difficult to quantify and difficult to implement practically. And so one of the thoughts I had, and maybe this is just a crazy thought, is, as I say, the issue, our experience, at least in the Canadian context, arises when you're in quarterly reporting dates where the time frames for filing your finance statements are much quicker. You don't, as compared to annual finance statements. And the question I had is whether it's possible to, for example, in the due process handbook dealing with IFRIC agenda decisions, to just state that, you know, they could be applied as at the beginning of the next fiscal year, and, you know, apply earlier if, you know, earlier adoption is permitted. So, as I say, taking away some of that time pressure that could exist and that we often face when it comes to agenda decisions that are finalized shortly around a quarter end. Now, I admit the same thing arises on annual finance statements, but I think you do typically have more time to deal with that when it comes to annual finance statements and if you're a public company filing requirements.
Bertrand?
I found the paper very interesting, I'm in agreement with the staff view. I think once again the paper is very well balanced, and I totally appreciated it that way. A couple of comments. I like the cost benefit approach far more, like Bruce, far more than the impracticability notion. Not necessarily that we will use it. I mean, just to put it very clear, when we have a change in accounting methods, whatever voluntary change in accounting method, first thing, it's very rare in practice. Generally, it's presentation issue, and so there's always then a retrospective application, a retrospective presentation of it. So let's put it that way, we are not supporting a cost-benefit approach. Does not mean that we won't do a retrospective application in any case. It's not what I'm saying. In effect, I mean, in my organization, nobody wants of a prospective application in most cases, because the users of the financial information, they need a comparative information. So in almost all cases, we will provide them with a retrospective comparative information, and therefore we would apply the change in accounting method retrospectively. But the simple fact that there exists a possibility in extremely rare circumstances whereby it makes no sense to provide to apply a change in accounting method retrospectively, or where it's too costly, or where it's just a nightmare to build the calculation, then I think it's a good thing to go in that route. Having said that, and for the same reason, I would have expanded this to all voluntary change in accounting methods, just because in effect I think it's not that you're providing with companies some form of I don't know how to say that, but you're not providing something that might be seen as a laxist requirement in any form. I mean, most of the time we would apply a change in accounting method retrospectively because we would want to provide users with a comparative information. So it would be in extremely rare circumstances where we would use where we would do things prospectively. And for sure then cost-benefit approach would enable entities to do so. So expanding it to all change in accounting, all voluntary changes in accounting methods, I think it would be a good thing.
Okay, thank you. Andrew.
I like this paper. I think it's got a lot of good and helpful proposals in it, so I think a lot of it's very, very helpful. I agree particularly, don't go looking at what's an error and what's a change in accounting policy, because there's work been done outside this space by in the regulatory environment. And I also agree with rejecting the proposal of prospective-only adoption. I don't think we should pursue that. In relation to the question of which changes in accounting policy should be included, there are two things that I think we need to consider. One is, I agree with Reinhard that when there's an agenda decision, many companies are forced to make the change. And that's, although it then is a voluntary change, it's a kind of quasi-voluntary change. It's perhaps less usual to see an accounting policy change outside agenda decisions. I don't see them very often. It maybe happens after a significant acquisition transaction where you're aligning intergroup accounting policies. It's comparatively unusual outside that. However, I would still be in favour of restricting this change only to those coming out of agenda decisions. Because of the rather unique nature of the changes in accounting policy that come from these. I do like the question of the costs and benefits, and I think that on the question, is application guidance helpful, I think it would be helpful, and I think constituents would welcome having that as a framework to follow.
Thank you. Bob.
I'm also, as many have commented around the table, very supportive of the direction that we're moving in this paper. I do like the idea of acknowledging in 8 agenda decisions and providing a clear path for transitions for those that are clearly not errors. With respect to lowering the threshold, I'm in agreement with the staff as to making a distinction between voluntary and agenda decisions. Has been said around the table, people who are in this situation where they have an agenda decision that they have to make a change, they don't feel it's so voluntary. They don't have the flexibility of time. They don't have the flexibility of whether to do it or not. So I think that is a good distinction. My caution and my little bit of my skepticism is around the lowering of the threshold. I'm not in disagreement with lowering the threshold for agenda decisions. It's the cost-benefit analysis. I think you could probably figure out costs. It's really around the benefit area. One obviously doesn't apply. I mean, when the board does a new standard, they think about in the cost-benefit and about transition, they think about comparability amongst a broad set of companies. Obviously, we can't think about that in terms of benefits. So what else do they need to think about? You brought up one thing in the paper, one-off transactions versus balances versus recurring transactions. I get that, but I'm still a bit skeptical about whether we can really measure the benefits. You know how hard it is to measure benefits from the board at the board level. And how does a preparer then prove that the benefits exceed the costs, or I'm sorry, the costs exceed the benefits, in order to not have to do retrospective? Maybe a way, but it's good to explore. I'm not sure we're going to be able to get there.
Can I ask you, Bob, and maybe you haven't thought that far, because I mean, I understand the concerns you're raising. Do you, at this stage, would you then suggest doing something different, or do you think it's worth still going down that route and maybe from your perspective thinking about are there other, so things like you mentioned you quite like the fact that under benefits we've already identified maybe thinking about one-off transactions versus something else. Do you think that we should try if we can't come up with some more things that are maybe slightly more objective under benefits, or does your concern around being able to measure benefits and demonstrate they are less than cost?
So I don't have another alternative for you on what to think about.
Okay.
So I am
worth exploring. Yeah. Yeah.
I just have a skepticism, especially coming in from a jurisdiction where you really have to document how you got there.
Would you like to come in?
Well, maybe it's a related point. Maybe I'll preface my comments by saying Maria and I talked ahead of time around this is a little bit of a difficult issue for us to sort of give a view on because it would be a board level project. Obviously, if the board took it on and put out an exposure draft, then within IOSCO Committee 1, we would consider it. So we don't know the views yet of those positions. So I'll answer more with my SEC staff hat on, and of course, all the normal SEC staff disclaimers apply. This is just my own view. But I do pause on this particular test of maybe adding a test where it's for the company to decide the cost versus the benefits. And it seems like maybe, and I was looking to see whether, is this new for a company to have to figure out the benefits to users themselves versus the cost? It seems like in other cases, it was helpful to have the literature references where it's more about the company determining, is it an undue cost? Not necessarily an undue cost versus benefits to users. Usually when we talk about benefits to users, a lot of times that's more of the standard setter or the regulator figuring out what are the benefits to users. And so it was just an observation, is that something new that companies would be asked to do? And then maybe to Bob's point, how would the companies document that, and how as regulators would we consider that? I mean, we can, there, you know, we do now question companies' judgments, and we would continue to do so, but it just, we're also thinking about it from an enforceability point of view, maybe it's a little bit more of a challenge. Not to say we couldn't do it, but.
I guess some of the wording we've used in other situations, not directly on point, is undue cost and effort. We certainly use that a bit on some of the transition choices that we've been using recently. Thanks, Jim.
I think this approach is always good, encouraging good behaviors. But can we really do that? Just like many of us have already mentioned, the difficulties in categorizing or even just measuring the benefits or even just figuring out the cost of doing so. So I think I really don't want to move further, I suggest not to move further on lowering the bars or really encouraging good behaviors, not by the word itself, because we cannot. Either identifying the voluntary good behaviors, we don't know whether that change is good or not. Just financial results are critical to the companies or to the users. Any change will be driven by the economic benefit out of it. Maybe there are better market value or better incentives or to the value that's measured by money, not by defining its good behavior. And some information sending out there may be good for a particular group of people, maybe bad for another group. It's very difficult to identify it's a voluntary good behavior. Even though I totally agree with the initiative that we should support, we should encourage good behaviors, but it's totally out of the capability of these kind of standards. It's a higher moral ground, but it's not practical for authorities or even for standard setters to really do this. So if someone claimed to have a justifiable cost-benefit result. You can't document it. You don't even know who is benefit from this decision, who is not. So I think the original thoughts of encouraging good behavior is always solid. It's higher moral ground whatsoever. But it's just not something we could do as a part of the standard setting group of people or authority we have, if we have any. But I think we will talk about it maybe in some general principle wordings. That's it. If we lower the bar, it could be misused or not even abused.
So
that's my concern.
So Jim, setting aside the sort of encouraging good behavior aspect for a second and focusing on the fact that people may choose or indeed be compelled to make changes to their accounting policy because of agenda decisions, do you think that we don't need to do anything to try and assist in those situations? You're comfortable with the current situation, is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think that the current solutions are fine, and if we do further down the path, we're running into more impracticalities and making the accountants and the firms difficult to either present their cases or making judgments on their presentations and cases.
All right, that's useful, thank you. Yang Su?
Yeah, I think Jim's thought is the same as mine. I thought about what is the real nature of the agenda decision. The agenda decision is a confirmation of the existing standard. That is why we are not issuing the other opinions like the interpretations. So if any company is doing something different from the agenda decision, it could be an error correction. So if we say it's an error correction, we cannot do anything but the retrospective method. I talked with the other several practitioners in Korea, and they said the same thing. They share the same idea with me. They say agenda decision is a kind of error correction, no more than that. That is why in Korea, I think many other jurisdictions are the same, but in Korea, the agenda decision is regarded as an official view of the committee or the board, and regarded as a mandatory change that the company must follow. So in that sense, I think that the threshold level for justifying impracticability should be high. And if we lower that too much, as Jim said, that could be used by the companies for maybe some structuring proposals, or maybe it can produce some kind of inconsistencies in applying the standard. Some company adopts it, some company does not adopt it. So again, there is going to be some diversity in the practice. One more thing I want to say is that I just look at the guidelines provided by the staff that at page 14 and 15, and I'm not really sure that the guidance is going to be really helpful and makes a consistent application of the cost and benefit criteria. So especially I agree with Bob that benefit cost is going to be not that difficult, but benefit is going to be really difficult for justifying. So, what I was trying to say was the same as what Jennifer said. Instead of saying cost and benefit, we can stress the importance of the cost side. So as other standards says, we can stress the importance of the undue cost. Then maybe we can, it can be more consistent with the other standards in terms of the not cost benefit criteria, but, in terms of lowering the impracticability threshold. And the last one I want to say is that maybe no one will agree with me on this one, but what I'm trying to say as the last one is that maybe we can provide some authority of IR policy to the agenda decision also. But what I'm trying to
right.
Authority of IR policy makes agenda decision the same as the IR policy standard. So I know you don't like that. But what I'm trying to say is that agenda decision, the nature of it is just a confirming of existing standard. We don't say any more than that. We just say that is what the standards say. So we have no more things than that. Then why don't we regard the agenda decision that a part of the IR policy? So that is actually what I really do not understand. So What I'm trying to say is that if we provide some authority of IR policy to the agenda decision, then all the worries you have would be just eliminated. We can provide some transition data to that. We can make some kind of, the exceptions, like the effective dates. And also in some other term, the agenda paper, we worry about the acknowledgement of the agenda decision. The people do not know much about our agenda decision, but if we make the agenda decision a part of the IR bylaws, provide official authority, people will pay attention to that. If I say just one word, lastly, maybe we can put agenda decision as a footnote in the IR bylaw standard. That's the idea I have. Do not make it in the part of the main part of the standard, but use it as a footnote and just explaining what that sentence and what the paragraph actually means and defined by the interpretations committee. I think we can solve many problems.
I think that's a more radical suggestion. I do hear you.
Extremely radical.
Now, Gary, you know that we think agenda decisions are voluntary before
I know.
You speak.
Yes, that's why I said you don't like that.
Yes, I do know they're voluntary as we write them. Local regulators might have alternative views, but and I'll probably say this at next week's board meeting, assuming the discussion goes this way. Actually, I like the direction of travel in the staff paper, but Bob said something that got me thinking, and having been a preparer most of my life in his jurisdiction, how do you document the benefit? I mean, I really don't know how I would really, 98% of the time I don't know how you would document that conclusively. Most people can get over the benefits, exceed the costs. So I think you're going to be into soft benefits. I mean, no one likes small restatements. So you'd say there's no benefit to rejiggering several years of an analyst's work from the past. And then we tend to think in terms of annual. The reality is that your restatements or retrospective is quarterly or semi-annual. It might be by segment, depending. And then you got to redo your deferred tax accounting in there, and so on. So all of a sudden, they got a lot of small numbers around the statements, in the main. And I just don't know how you document the benefit. And I suspect long-term fundamental analysis doesn't change. Short-term sell-side, buy-side analysis might. I'm just putting it into the room for consideration. We'll process it a little bit more today and starting next week. But maybe it's management representation letter, the CFO's judgment. There's no, costs, don't exceed the benefit. I don't know. But I think if that's the direction we go, I think we got to think, how do you communicate what we view as the relevant benefits?
Okay. Thanks, Gary. So, something for us to think about and maybe for people to comment on. Tony.
So, like others, I thought this was a good paper. I think it is the right direction to go in. I agree with the staff that there's no need to re-examine or reconsider what constitutes an error. And I support the idea of providing some relief from the impracticable test when an agenda decision is adopted. Listening to what other people have said, I'm not sure I would object to exploring whether it was undue cost or effort rather than costs exceed benefits, just whether there's a way of recognizing the difficulty that would exist in assessing the benefits. I guess one of the things that occurred to me, if we end up saying, well, there's going to be some different guidance for adopting an agenda decision from other voluntary changes in accounting policy, I guess I may have a slightly different view to the one that Reinhardt had, is that I'm not sure that I would necessarily say if we published an agenda decision on June 29th, that I would necessarily insist that was adopted in half-year financial statements. But if that's the case, then it does pose an interesting question, is how long does a company have to voluntarily adopt an agenda decision before it becomes a voluntary change in accounting policy? So, say I might not insist that it was adopted if we issued an agenda decision sort of right on the period end, but then is it next quarter? Do you get to the first set of annual financial statements? I think that's just, it's a question that would be worth pondering.
I don't know the answer, but yes.
No, I don't know the answer either. It occurred to me as a question.
Bonnie?
If I look at in the paper on page 7, paragraph 12 in the board paper, I think what struck me was the agenda decisions do not have the authority of IFRSs, and they will therefore not provide mandatory requirements, but they should be seen as helpful, informative, and persuasive. And to me, that does not necessarily create a separate category that you would look at under IS-8, but rather that's a characteristic that you should look at within IS-8 itself. Either it's an error or it's a voluntary change. So I didn't really like alternative 2, which was to change IS-8 specifically for agenda decisions, because I think you have to look at it in context of IS-8. The other point that I wanted to make was consistent with what some others have said, is I do like the approach of adding another qualitative assessment of whether or not it makes sense to go retrospective, which is whether that's undue cost and effort, which I think may be easier and an easier threshold to apply in practice versus the cost benefit for some of the reasons that others have articulated. So.
Thank you. Mary.
A couple of thoughts, and I think first a clarification, and that I think most people are in agreement with, but one or two comments, maybe just want to say it explicitly, that the type of change that the staff is exploring in the paper that the board will discuss is not about whether to adopt or not a voluntary change, but whether or not that change must be applied retrospectively. And just one or two people made comments that suggested that they might be thinking that some of the considerations about cost benefit, et cetera, related to whether or not to make the change when it's actually questioning whether or not to make it retrospective or not. So that just was a point of clarification. And the other part, worrying a bit that I'm climbing on a soapbox here, is I'm going to go back to Sandy's question at the very beginning of this. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this now? And I think part of it is the continual a challenge to us that maybe came out of some of the reflection from agenda consultation and also our trustees consultation about how can the application of standards continue to improve after the initial adoption of a standard. And you know, there's a lot of tension and pressure and concern that if you make a change, it will be construed as error correction. And are there too many barriers to improving accounting? I mean, I think one of the things that happens with many of the issues submitted to the Interpretation Committee is that the process of information gathering about what practice is, whether or not there's diversity, how people have analyzed it, the staff taking the time to analyze the issue and bring it to this group for consideration, is part of collectively the community getting smarter about what, you know, what the standards say, and out of that learning, maybe wanting to look again at accounting that has been applied in the past. And I can understand why, if you are very analytical about it, it says once we've gotten smarter, everything before was an error. But I think that is so punitive that as long as the committee is disciplined about what it discusses as reasonable potential readings of the standards, that then is part of looking for ways to help the process get smarter and better in the application without it always being full-blown standard setting. So I think that's why we're trying to do it. I think it's very useful to have this discussion at the Interpretation Committee. I'm betting it won't be the last time we have some of it, because I think if we all share that objective, and I include the regulatory community, I think then we want to look for ways to get there in the right balance of discipline and information that's useful for users, because users are well served by ongoing improvements in the application. And it's just to pick your brains about what you think is the best way to strike that balance. The staff is bringing for the board to discuss is relief on retrospective application with, in some ways, a radical idea of entity-specific assessment of cost-benefit rather than a determination made by the board. But I think we're just trying to balance all these factors and thinking about what will collectively move us ahead and what can we all buy into. So it's just the beginning of a discussion, I think.
Mary, can you please repeat again your first comments on you made relating to retrospective application?
What I was saying is the discussion that's in here is about whether or not there's a way to reduce barriers to making voluntary changes, looking at retrospective application. It really is not around, the staff says explicitly this is not error, around error correction and determining where the line is drawn, but it's also not trying to make it...
should I change my policy or not?
It's
not that.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Because I think for the reasons Bonnie gave a shout out to from the due process handbook, I think there are reasons why the community would expect if there's information that comes out of an agenda decision that provides insight into the application. We're not trying to roll that back.
I ask again the question, Mary, because probably part of my comment would be in your sense. I think, because I've heard many of the members using the word lowering the threshold to switching from impracticable to cost benefits. I understand, because impracticability means it almost never applies. So effectively, if you move, you would lower. But so impracticable is never practicable, or almost never practicable. So is then the impracticability notion really relevant? Not sure we can say that. So obviously you would lower the threshold, but probably I would say it differently. You would define differently the threshold so that it becomes maybe more meaningful than before. And then cost benefits, also difficulty to assess. I mean, from being an IFRS constituent, I would say it's a principle-based standard. I would do it qualitatively. I mean, it's quite obvious. What I've said earlier, as a preparer, in almost all cases, we would apply a change in accounting method, is a voluntary change in accounting method, retrospectively, whatever the possibilities we have not to do so, because we would be inclined to provide users with comparative information. So we would do it retrospectively for sure, in most cases, or in almost all cases. But there are some situations where a change is not impracticable in the meaning of IS 8 now, but cost benefits, you can question that. Let's assume you are a telecommunication company, you have 1 million items of PP&E, and there is an agenda decision that says that a cost that you had capitalized in the past can no longer be capitalized. So impracticable, it's not impracticable to reassess your gross amount of PP&E. Sometimes some of them you might have bought or 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. So you would do that for your 1 million pieces of items, and then you would recalculate all and recompute all your amortization expense and so on. So it's not impracticable to do so. So cost benefit, then Is it, the cost, I can see, it's burdensome. You have the link with the statutory accounts, with the tax effects relating to a change in the amortization expense. So the cost, I can see. The benefit, I don't see them very much in this specific example.
So overall, Bertrand, do you think it's worth trying for a cost-benefit cut? Because you think it would be possible to apply it?
Cost benefit, yeah. I think so. Above all, if you have in mind the fact that it would apply rarely in practice, and so it would be, as Mary mentioned, it would be, it would just, if it lowers something, it would just lower the hurdle to change.
Thank you, Martin.
Well, first of all, I would not make any differentiation between alternative A and B of the board papers. So my view is that this borderline could be, in a way, artificial. For me, it's the question, what is the more valuable information? Is it about the past or is it about the future? And what experiences one might have collected and seen at the market? And I agree that, in general, accounting policy changes do not happen that often. It might happen due to the fact that the company enters into a new business, has had a huge acquisition, and therefore other business models become more important or so, and then it is said, okay, a better, these other policy fits better. But overall, I mean, what have we seen, for example, in the way how companies have selected their high-quality corporate bonds? We have seen a lot of changes with regard to that. All have been labeled, in general, as change in accounting estimate. Why I'm referring to that example, because specifically if you see what kind of disclosures you have to give for change in accounting estimate, it is nothing. It is not nothing. It is a lot. It means for the current period you have disclosed the effect of more or less old and new principle, and what is the estimated effects for future periods, unless it is impracticable to do so. So I guess these are really valuable information for analysts, and no, at least I'm not aware of that. No one really complained that it was not accounted for as a change in accounting policy. So nothing was missing. So this is my argument for arguing that, in general, I would assume that more forward-looking information, when we have a change in accounting policy, is valuable in a way. On the other hand, what I believe is very valuable is a clear explanation from the company why it is applying that approach. And this more or less comes also to the argument of Bertrand, that in general, the company has more or less the pressure from capital markets to provide comparable figures. And this can happen in different ways, so to say. So there might be cases where you have a change in accounting policy where the backward looking might be very important, and other cases where the backward looking, in a way, is not that important also for the investor community. And I guess it's very important, both could be applied, and it's very important then to explain why. So I have mixed arguments in a way. However, more in favor to lower the threshold compared to the status quo.
Okay, thank you. And that's actually a good reminder to watch out for accounting estimates versus policy, right? Which feeds into our other project that the board's doing. Thank you, Martin. John, did you want to come in?
Yeah, just to make a couple of comments. I mean, most of it's been covered. I mean, I did want to commend the staff on bringing this paper forward. I think it's quite thought-provoking and I think timely to sort of raise some of the issues that are canvassed in the paper. I do agree with the conclusion not to consider error corrections versus voluntary changes in policy. I support that. I was interested in the rationale that is in the paper in paragraph 17 for why changes arising as a result of agenda decisions are voluntary changes in accounting policy and not corrections of errors. I mean, I subscribe to much of that thinking, but I don't think that's written anywhere currently in the literature as being a distinction. So the fact that the committee has sat and deliberated an issue, and that the committee is made up of experts from all over the world, and they've had various discussions on alternatives, might render something a change in accounting policy rather than an error. I think that's quite an interesting analysis in that paragraph. I think that just a couple of comments on the paper. I do think what this, because this is going to create a distinction between the accounting for voluntary changes in accounting policy and for error corrections, today the accounting for those is the same. So even though, you know, you might say there's a big difference between an error correction and a voluntary change in accounting policy in terms of its nature, disclosure requirements are basically the same. The accounting effect is basically the same. It's retrospective application. What this move would do is change. Obviously, the voluntary changes in accounting policy would now be accounted for differently in many instances than error correction, and therefore the conclusion as to whether something is an error correction or is a voluntary change in accounting policy is going to be much more important. I think that may lead to maybe increased pressure on the committee to provide guidance on issues that it deliberates on as to whether it would be, those issues would be justified as a change in accounting policy or not when it actually issues its agenda decisions. So I think the discussion ought to consider what some of the flow-on consequences might be out of creating this difference in accounting between those two situations. Finally, I don't think this change can just be limited to agenda decisions. I don't see why the source of a voluntary change in policy should give you different accounting. I think it also runs the risk that you're actually giving agenda decisions some form of exalted, non-authoritative status. Now, I might like that as a committee member, but I'm not sure that I think you actually start to change the balance of what an agenda decision is and is not by saying that changes that arise as a result of an agenda decision get some special status that other changes do not. I would not be in favour of that.
Okay, thank you. There's another couple of people at the table, but before I go to them, Sandy, did you have anything you wanted to say?
Sorry, I was trying to get on unmute here. You know, I guess as I read this, I worried about the reduction of the use of restating, because I think it was Alan Teixeira one time who said at this committee, we only do retrospective application when it's easy. And so I worry about this. I worry about that a bit. And you, Martin said something to the effect of, you know, investors are concerned more with forward-looking information. And I agree with that, but this isn't forward-looking in the sense of making change contemporaneously in this period isn't necessarily forward-looking. It's simply giving me the information today. But doing it on a retrospective basis gives you actually a trend and gives you some indication of what the effects might be in the future. I agree with some of the things that John said about giving this a degree of exalted status. I don't know that investors are so concerned about the difference between a change in accounting estimate and a change in accounting principle. I think they are concerned when something was an error and it's adjusted and why that was adjusted. If it was something where there was a difference in interpretation and the board concluded that there needed to be, or the interpretations committee concluded that there needed to be clarification on that, and that that was sort of broadly across all the entities, that would be, you know, something that would be received differently than if something is a change, a voluntary change in accounting principle or an error. Maybe I say it to be better understood. But I don't know. I'm sort of mixed minds of it, and I sort of was, why now? You know, I do worry of saying it will be used in many instances not to do retrospective application. And that would be my concern, when there might be useful information, trend information in that. So I don't know where exactly I come out, but those are just some of my concerns.
Okay, thank you. Bruce.
Thanks. I'll be brief, given I know we're running long on this. What's interesting listening to the conversation around the table is that when I listen to those of you who are in countries where these are mandated, you've already jumped to, we need to solve this issue, and there was resolution around agenda decisions. But my concern is that we don't know what an agenda decision is. At the moment, and Sue just mentioned earlier, these are voluntary things that are put out. And leading to John's point, the moment we have to start considering whether this is an error or whether this is a change in policy, I do not believe that these will be seen still as, you can choose to do it if you want, but by the way, we're telling you it's an error. You can't do that. You just cannot reconcile the two. It becomes impossible. So if I had to say anything, I think to me what the board needs to decide is, what are the status of agenda decisions? And I think that the status of the agenda decisions, I actually believe, is a secondary question, is a different question to what's being asked in the paper. The paper's talking about, do we need to lower the threshold in terms of changes in accounting policy? And I think that's a decision we can make regardless of our decision on agenda decisions. I think if we believe agenda decisions fall into that, I think that's a completely different question in terms of saying, do we think the status of an agenda decision is going to push you to a change in policy or error? Because until we resolve to people whether they have to or don't have to do it, what I say says becomes irrelevant. We need to decide what is an agenda decision, do you have to apply it or not? If the answer is no, we can exclude it from this paper. It's actually nothing to do with the discussion.
Reacting as one individual board member, I don't think we are thinking about questioning what the status of an agenda decision is. I think we think it's voluntary as part of the literature.
But the moment you put it into this paper and made it a factor in the determination of a change to IS8, you are elevating it.
Even if we don't comment, even if we don't make the distinction between different types of voluntary policy?
Yeah, you've kind of opened the can of worms once this paper's up there. And I think
so
that's going to be
a challenge.
You
do nothing on balance?
No, I'm happy to. I mean, that's what I'm saying to you. I think that the two are separate. I think that the change in IS8 around the accounting policy, I'm supportive of, because I do think there are situations. I mean, I agree with what Bertrand said. Very few people are not going to want to change it unless they genuinely believe there's a challenge. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying I think that the lowering the threshold, I'm supportive of. Whether that's cost-benefit, undue cost and effort can be debated. I'm saying that the question around an agenda decision is, do we think agenda decisions need a different status? Do we think they need to be something where we as a committee now need to decide, hang on, we need, for want of a better word, transitional provisions in these? But the moment we start addressing that, I mean, if we look at the one we did this morning on intangibles, it was almost unanimous, other than and Bob's view, that no, but I mean, we did. I mean, everybody agreed that IS38, I mean, that the view we're putting out is IS38 says you do it this way. Mm-hmm. Now, if we decide that these have got a higher status, are we saying that that's an error if you're doing it the other way? At the moment, we didn't have to address it because we're just saying, well, that's our view. The moment we've slightly elevated these things, we're going to have to comment on whether we think this is an error or you can apply as a change in policy. And the moment you're doing that, we're standard setting.
I don't think that's our intent, but I hear your caution. Andrew, then I want to try and wrap it up.
I'll just comment on the point of error versus accounting policy, otherwise I'll miss it out at the end. I don't think it would be our job at all to comment on whether something is an error correction or a policy change, because that is going to depend on the facts and circumstances of each preparer, what it's done in the past, and what it's moving to, and what the difference is, and why we're making the change. So I don't think that we could say, this one gives you an error correction, and this one gives you a policy choice, or a policy change. We say, here's the guidance, you preparer, go and decide. As we went around the table, though, I was just reflecting a little bit on the first question, which was why and why now? And if I look at the way that the committee's output is dealt with at the moment, we out listening to constituents, there's an awful lot of pressure around agenda decisions and interpretations. And the reason for that is that an agenda decision by its nature cannot have any transitional provisions, whereas an interpretation can. And that's why I think we're getting a number of requests from constituents for things where perhaps they wouldn't merit an interpretation. People say, oh, please give us an interpretation. And you say, well, why do you want that? You can put some transitional rules in so it eases our ability to adopt this. So I think there's a very practical point here. It may not be absolutely crystal clean and clear on from a technical perspective, but we need something practical for people to deal with here. And this links into the timing, because I think there's building pressure on that as the committee becomes more active, as it has more output, where there are going to be more and more requests, more and more pressure for us to do interpretations and not agenda decisions. And that takes me into where we're heading in 2018 onwards, where we have IFRS 9, 15, 16, and in a few years IFRS 17, where I think although people will get themselves over the line in terms of adopting these standards, there's going to be a period of years of what you might call shakedown of adoption, where there were, I suspect, we're going to get a lot of questions. And so the timing of this, in my view, is very good. And personally, as a member of the committee, I would encourage the board to press ahead with this as soon as they possibly can, because I think it's very necessary, and I think it would be very much welcomed by our constituents out there.
Thank you. Bertrand.
Yeah, just
going to give you the final word.
Yeah, very quickly, I just had a question for Bruce, just to make sure I fully appreciate his comments. Would your comments also mean that you ask yourself the question how to differentiate the outcomes of the IFRS Interpretations Committee activities? So when you have just an agenda decision, and then it becomes a change in let's assume a change in accounting method by comparison to a regular standard setting activity, is it also what's your remark?
I'm saying we don't have a solution right now, because at the moment the agenda decisions are just voluntary, so we don't have to apply them. And I think that's the key thing about this, is it's just getting us to a different level.
Okay, thank you very much. That was very interesting, and some good additions for us to share with the board.